From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, an appeal for a humanitarian pause in the fighting in Yemen. Chances of the latest Syrian negotiations succeeding.
Clearly, there is no military solution, but at the same time, there's no political solution.
A new report says 38 million people are now internally displaced, and efforts to prepare for the quake in Nepal. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry continued his talks with Saudi officials in Riyadh as he pushed for a humanitarian pause in the Saudi-led coalition's five-week bombing campaign targeting Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen. The United Nations says more than 600 civilians have been killed since the start of the airstrikes in late March, while some 300,000 have been displaced. The conflict has disrupted the flow of supplies to the country, where both the UN and a Yemeni NGO believe as many as 20 million people, about 80% of the population, is going hungry. Mr. Kerry Wednesday announced nearly $70 million in humanitarian assistance, including food, water, and shelter. Mideast analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania tells VOA's Victor Beatty, beyond a pause, the bigger question is, can the United States persuade Saudi Arabia to get out of the Yemeni conflict altogether?
Their actions have dragged the United States into a multilateral mess where we are confronting multiple enemies in the Arabian Gulf while a situation is created that makes it increasingly difficult to deal with the Iranian situation and the ISIS situation. I'm very sad about the situation in Yemen. I think we have been dragged into something that we should never have allowed ourselves to be dragged into.
Is that because we allowed and backed, in fact, the Saudi air campaign?
That's right. And I think we were in a difficult place because the Saudis are such important allies to us, and they have a new government or the new king. And that new government is taking decisions in a way that previous Saudi governments have not. The current king has consolidated power around himself and a few close relatives and has closed himself off in many respects to the wider consultations with the political class in Saudi Arabia that had always tended to make decisions by the Saudi government more prudent and risk-averse. Here you see a very bold, even reckless policy that seems like it's generated more by an internal politics in Saudi Arabia and by some kind of moral panic that the Shia need to be confronted in some way more vigorously by Saudi power.
If the Saudis agree to a pause, will that cede the country to the Houthis?
For all we have seen, the Saudi onslaught has not stopped the expansion of Houthi power. Repeatedly, the press has published maps showing Houthi expansion into regions well beyond where they occupied prior to the Saudi air campaign. It's unlikely that the Houthis could be stopped since they have an alliance with most of the Yemeni army, loyal essentially to the former dictator. So it's not just a matter of ceding Yemen to the Houthis. It's really the Houthis in alliance with the tribes and the military that were associated with the previous dictator.
How big a role, if any, is Iran playing in this crisis?
I do not believe Iran is playing a very big role. You have to go back to the fact that although the Houthis are Shia, they are not the same kind of Shia as the Iranians. And they were allied with the Saudis in the earlier Yemen war when the Saudis fought the Egyptians. So these are not Houthis with a diabolical enmity towards Saudi Arabia. They are former allies. They are hardened fighters. But you also have al-Qaeda in southeastern Yemen, and they had an interest in transforming the struggle in Yemen into one in which they could claim that they, the paragons of virtue of Sunni Islam in their lights, were defending Sunnis against the Shia heretics. So they're the ones that wanted the conflict to be defined as a Shia-Sunni conflict instead of an internal tribal and political conflict in Yemen. And the Saudis jumped on that bandwagon, and the United States has been dragged in behind them, even as we are trying to sort out the different kinds of relationships we need to have with Shia Iran over the nuclear weapons and over containing ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Lustig says the Houthis are natural enemies of the Sunni al-Qaeda fighters in Yemen, and like Iran, fighting alongside the U.S.-backed Iraqi government against the Islamic State, Washington could find itself in an unlikely alliance with the Houthis against al-Qaeda in Yemen. The United Nations is hosting indirect talks between rival sides involved in the conflict in Syria. 4 to 6 weeks of talks are planned in Geneva. UN envoy Stéphane de Mistura is said to be meeting separately with each party, including both government and opposition representatives. The Islamic State group and the al-Qaeda-linked Jabhat al-Nusra have not been invited. UN officials described the latest round of talks as an effort to see whether the will and conditions exist to restart the peace process. Two earlier rounds of talks broke down more than a year ago. They were aimed at brokering a ceasefire and launching a Syrian-led political transition that would lead the country out of crisis. Since then, however, the challenge in Syria has grown more complex. Islamic State fighters have seized large areas in the eastern part of the country, while existing rebel and militant groups are continuing to battle pro-government forces. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Edmund Garib of American University in Washington about the chances for success of this latest international effort to end the Syrian conflict.
Professor Garib, both Secretary of State John Kerry and White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice stressed that there is no military solution to the Syrian conflict. However, training and equipping the Syrian opposition fighters will start this month. How do you explain that?
Clearly, there is no military solution, but at the same time, there is no political solution. So what we are seeing and what we're likely to see is continued support for the parties, basically in the hope of gaining an advantage. And they also will try to change the political realities on the ground, the political and military balance on the ground. Because there is a perception, there is a belief that we're not likely to see any changes and any real opportunities for dialogue unless there is the beginning of a change in the balance of power on the ground inside Syria. And so one of the main reasons behind the support which is being provided to the Syrian opposition is to help create this kind of balance in order to strengthen the chances of reaching some kind of a negotiation and the beginning of real negotiations between the different plans.
Talking about that, UN envoy to Syria started an effort to explore whether the Syrian government and the opposition representatives are ready to restart a political dialogue to end the conflict. Could the rising threat from ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra compel the two sides to compromise this time?
That possibility is always there, although I think it's still highly unlikely that we're going in that direction right now. I think the UN envoy, de Mistura, what he's trying to do is he's trying to explore the chances between the different parties, the different players. He's inviting numerous groups as well as individuals who are active in the Syrian opposition, in addition to a delegation from the Syrian government. So as a result of this, what I think what de Mistura is trying to do is trying to listen to the different parties in the hope that finding ways to try to bridge the differences among the two sides and whether or not this possibility exists. And if he finds that it does exist, then we are likely to move from consultations to negotiations. There have been a number of statements coming out that probably the end of this phase will be at the end of June, at the same time that the Iran negotiations are likely to end. Although de Mistura has also said that he will not have an automatic cutoff, but he will continue to a later period. But I think the most significant part of this is that what de Mistura also may be trying to do is to sound out the different parties which support different groups, whether it's the parties which support the Syrian regime on the one hand or the parties which support the Syrian opposition, be they regional players or international players, to find out whether or not they are ready to sit down and to reach some kind of a compromise. Because I think their role, we are not likely to see a significant change unless the big players are also, who are supporting this or that party, are also willing to begin to reach some kind of an accommodation and to find that their interests may require them to begin to reach an accommodation between the different players.
Iran was not invited to the previous Geneva meetings on Syria, and there are reports saying that it has been invited to this UN informal peace effort. How could that impact the prospects of success?
Primarily, there have been attempts to try to bring Iran in. If you remember, Lakhdar al-Brahimi wanted to do that. There were others who wanted to include Iran in the negotiations, but there was at that time very strong opposition, including from the United States, to Iranian participation. I think that there is a growing recognition, but in part as a result of the negotiations between Iran and the 5+1, and also because of the changing realities on the ground, that perhaps it might be very useful to have Iran play a role. Iran is well known for its support of the Syrian regime, and as a result of that, it's one of the major players. So I think there is going to be an effort to find out where does Iran stand, and could it be possible that Iran could perhaps pressure the Syrian regime to try to make some accommodations with the opposition. And I think this, to a certain extent, also applies to Russia. There's a general belief that because these two countries are supporting the Syrian regime, there is a need to explore and find out where they are likely to make some changes in their stand, and if they are ready to make those changes. At the same time, I think the Russians and the Iranians are likely to also see if they can get concessions from the backers of the Syrian opposition. And so there might be an opportunity at least to begin to have a real dialogue, but I don't think that we're likely to see that happen until we begin to see where the Iranian negotiations over the nuclear issue, where those are going.
Edmund Gharib, professor of Middle East history at American University in Washington. More people than ever before have been forced to flee their homes because of violence and conflict. A new report by the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center finds a record-breaking 38 million people worldwide were internally displaced in 2014, including 11 million who were newly displaced. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
This is the third year in a row that internal displacement figures have reached record highs, and the numbers are staggering. The report says that last year, an average of 30,000 people were forced to flee their homes every day because of conflict or violence. Authors of the report note that the figure of 38 million internally displaced people is equivalent to the populations of London, New York, and Beijing combined. The report, which covered 60 countries, finds a majority of last year's 11 million newly displaced were in five countries alone: Iraq, South Sudan, Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. The worst displacement, it says, occurred in Iraq, where 2.2 million people were forced to flee from attacks by the Islamic State militant group. But Syria has the highest number of internally displaced people in the world, with at least 40% of its population, or 7.6 million people, uprooted within their country. For the first time in more than a decade, the report notes Europe experienced massive displacement due to the war in Ukraine, where 646,500 people fled their homes in 2014. This brings the total number of people displaced by the war between the government and Russian-backed rebels to more than 1.2 million. Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, which oversaw production of the report, calls the global internal displacement problem a very dangerous trend. He warns national problems increasingly are turning into regional ones.
There is a domino effect. Boko Haram is now a problem, not only from Nigeria, but for the neighboring countries. IS is not only a tremendous displacer in Syria, but also in Iraq, and vice versa. The problems are getting regional. The way it is now, it cannot continue. What we hope is that this report will be a wake-up call. More and better national action for the most vulnerable, and more and better international action for the most vulnerable.
Egeland says the right actions taken in a timely manner can head off the worst. For example, he says Yemen is at a crossroads and that the choice is between ending the conflict now and letting it develop into a tremendous war for the next 10 years. By this same reasoning, he tells VOA that Burundi is at the brink of a disaster and the international community should pay attention.
All lights are blinking in Burundi. All alarm bells are going. So where's the fire brigade? I think that many good people are locally trying to do the right things and avoid more ethnic violence. But the signs are very, very worrying. And it is precisely now there should be a coherent regional and international action to help those in Burundi who want to avert a new catastrophe. Now is the time.
Burundi had 77,600 internally displaced people in 2014. Figures for this year have not yet been documented, but the report's authors say violence is increasing the number of forcible displacements both within and outside the country. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 39,000 Burundians so far this year have fled to Rwanda, Congo, and Tanzania. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The regional coordinator for a U.S.-based global earthquake safety organization says given South Asia's location on a seismic fault line, poor building construction, lax enforcement, and rapid urbanization could result in even more casualties in a future earthquake of the magnitude of the April 25th quake that devastated Nepal, leaving more than 7,500 people dead. Hari Kumar of the California-based Go Hazards International says scientists in the region knew a large earthquake was expected, they just didn't know where. Kumar, speaking from New Delhi, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Nepal had been working with his organization to make its schools stronger against earthquakes, a process called retrofitting, but it was plagued by limited funds.
Look at what Kathmandu was doing and look at our own program. Are we prepared? Are you ready to handle a similar earthquake in one of our hill towns? I would consider India's response to Kathmandu as earthquake as very good. But in Kathmandu, the airport is right in the middle of the city. It's a large international airport where you can bring in a lot of relief and aid. But there are several towns in India itself which have a huge population, over 300,000, without an airport. How would you deal with those situations?
How did you help retrofit schools?
We had actually worked together with a national non-governmental organization called Nepal Society for Earthquake Technology. Many of the schools they had retrofitted without any damage and are being currently used as relief distribution centers.
How else can Nepal help ease the damage in future earthquakes?
The learning from Nepal itself, that is the most important lesson. What has happened there, I wish this would provoke many of our countries to look honestly at what can happen if there is an earthquake today. Many of us are congratulating ourselves on the way we have responded, but I think this is the time for us also to look at how we would have responded if this has happened in one of our own cities. What would have actually happened? There are several things lacking in the way we construct our buildings. There are good building codes in most of our countries, but the enforcement is sadly lacking. We will not be able to retrofit all our buildings, all residential buildings. But at least look at the most important buildings in each city. What happened to the hospitals in Kathmandu should not happen to hospitals again. Most of the treatment was done out in the parking lot. So the functionality of hospitals is very important. For a hospital to be functional, it's not enough that the building be built well, but also what all can, the utilities, the furniture, the equipment, they all should withstand the shaking during the earthquake.
GeoHazards is working with the government in Bhutan to put in place separate 20-year national action plans to make sure both its schools and hospitals are safe from earthquake damage and the populace is better prepared to cope with the aftermath of such a natural disaster. Today is the National Day of Prayer in the United States. There will be ceremonies at state capitals across the country. But one group of fervent Christians has been reading the entire Bible on the steps of the U.S. Capitol in anticipation. VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski reports.
And the Lord shall be king over all the earth.
They read from the book of Zechariah on the fourth day of this Bible reading marathon, a yearly event before the National Day of Prayer. 90 hours of nonstop reading of both the Old and New Testaments on the steps of the U.S. Capitol.
It's a way that we can pray for our nation. And so much is going on now around the world, so much unrest. And I just want to show people the love of Christ.
Some visitors accepted that love and the Pentecostal-style blessing. Others watched with detached curiosity. Jim Mahoney is visiting from Minnesota.
I was in front of the White House last night, and there was a guy with a bullhorn slinging a message, and that was not very pleasant. It was just too loud, but this is fine.
Between the righteousness...
The marathon is not an official event. The First Amendment to the Constitution wouldn't allow it. But it does allow this event on Capitol grounds, organized by local pastor Michael Hall.
I think by doing this that God will bless this nation, that God will help this nation, and God will protect this nation.
Many Americans see prayer as something that's done at home or in a church, but these people see it as a strategic action that will help America's standing in the world. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia, Kenya, and neighboring East African nations continue to combat the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Though government troops and African Union peacekeepers have driven the terrorists from Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, and other areas of the country, they still pose a major threat from terrorist actions that have cost hundreds of innocent lives and driven hundreds of thousands from their homes. Throughout this fight, the United States, along with others in the international community, has provided training and other support for the region's security forces. The area's peace and stability are vital to the security of all of Africa, and for the United States, too. Secretary of State John Kerry recently traveled to Kenya to confirm that support. He noted that the recent tragedies in Garissa, Mandera, Wajir, Mombasa, and elsewhere may cause momentary turmoil, grief, and chaos. But in the end, instead of dividing us, they bring us closer together, and they will never shake our commitment to human decency, dignity, and peace. Defeating terrorism requires a long-term effort. It requires a comprehensive strategy. Border security and law enforcement are a big part of the equation, both of which must factor respect for basic human rights and the rule of law. That effort must have the support of religious authorities, educators, and citizens who will discredit hateful doctrines and help people to build stronger and more resilient communities. The success of this strategy depends on building trust between the authorities and local communities. America has learned in our own fight against terrorism that we have to be true to democratic values, not just because it's right, but also because it's the only sure path to security over the long term. The more united and proud of its institutions that a country is, the stronger it is going to be in fighting back against the threats of terror. The power to fight back, however, includes something that may even be more powerful than the military and law enforcement, and it may make a bigger difference in the end. That is our unity in the face of the threat and the character of our ideals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.